A couple of questions follow just about all violent crimes. How could this happen, for one, and who would do such a thing? Those are certainly among the questions after a dual rape and single murder in Seattle several years ago. A couple of young women planning to marry were attacked in their home. One survived. The man who attacked them went to prison amid serious doubts about his mental competency. The story is told in the book While the City Slept by Eli Sanders. Eli is the associate editor of The Stranger, a weekly newspaper in Seattle. His reporting on this very case for The Stranger won a Pulitzer Prize for Eli in 2012. His work has also appeared in the Seattle Times and the New York Times, among other outlets. Eli Sanders, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So what was it about this case that made it so riveting? Something, I mean, and I understand once you get into the book, but for you in particular and your readers, what got you into it?
Well, this crime happened in 2009, and it really shocked the city because of the horror of what happened. This was a man, Isaiah Kalebu, who invaded the home of two women that they shared in South Park, which is a neighborhood just to the south of Seattle. And over the course of 90 minutes, attacked them, had a knife with him, and threatened each with harming the other if they didn't do what he said. And he raped both of them and attempted to kill both of them. He did kill Teresa Butts as she fought back and ultimately stabbed her through the heart, and she died on the street in front of her house. And Jennifer Hopper was able to escape out the front door and get help from neighbors. And so this really horrified the community. It horrified the city, and it naturally raised the questions you posed. How could this happen, and who was the person who committed this crime? And after he was arrested after a manhunt about 5 days later, I started looking into that question. And I ended up staying with this case for many, many years, and now have written this book, which traces all three of the lives that intersected in this crime. All three of these lives have important things to teach us. And the life of Isaiah Kalebu really reveals stark failings in our criminal justice and mental health systems that allowed him to be free at a time when he really shouldn't have been, and even before that, failed to intervene in the life of someone who was showing very clear and very serious signs of a mental illness that, for him, was connected to violence.
I should underscore what you just said about you follow all three lives through the book, because you follow them extensively. We get to know a lot about the backgrounds of all three people, Teresa Butts, Jennifer Hopper, and Isaiah Kalebu. And it's a very human book for that reason. I mean, it's less a cops and courts kind of thing than it is just to get to know the people involved here. You do walk us through what happened, and we essentially get to see the aftermath of the crime through witnesses who saw it on the street. Also through the eyes of a detective who got there first. And there were some things that she noticed about the crime scene that made it a bit different from some others. What were some of the things that she noticed that made her think this is not a usual kind of case?
Well, yes, as you said, at the beginning of the book, we see just the aftermath of the crime very opaquely. And the detective, Dana Duffy, who was one of the first responders to the scene and was assigned to this case, the most unusual thing that she pointed out was that there was a survivor. In most cases like this, she has a victim or two victims, and there's no one there to tell her what happened. And so what was most unusual was that Jennifer had survived and was, at the moment when Dana Duffy, the detective, was beginning to investigate this, was at an emergency room nearby. So Dana went very quickly and began talking to Jennifer Hopper about what she remembered and what she had witnessed, and that began a relationship between the two of them as detective and witness that lasted for years and up to the trial, when Jennifer testified against Isaiah Kalebu in court. And it was that testimony, that really clear, powerful, stunningly purposeful testimony that Jennifer gave out of a desire to let people know who had been lost. I mean, this was her fiance who had been killed, and also to get justice for the both of them. That testimony inspired me to write a piece about what she had done in court, and that piece was the one that won the Pulitzer Prize for feature writing in 2012. So the most unusual thing, to answer your question, about the crime for Detective Duffy was that there was someone there to tell her about it.
You know, and I guess both women really appreciated directness, you know, getting right to the point of what was going on. And Jennifer certainly delivered on the stand in the trial. But she also had a good moment with Dana Duffy, basically, as they first met, because nobody had told her that Teresa Butts was dead until the detective came in her room. And that's a really pivotal moment in the book, in my mind, is that she just was honest with her. She said, no, she didn't make it.
Yeah, yeah. You're right that both Teresa and Jennifer are tough people who like just to be told what's going on. And Jennifer was waiting for someone to tell her. There were people shielding her from the truth out of a good motivation, but she just wanted to know the truth. And Detective Duffy is someone else who likes to get right to the point, you know, no sense hiding anything. And so she, when Jennifer asked, you know, did Teresa make it, she just said no, she didn't. And that gave Jennifer some very bad news, and obviously, and she reacted, but it also gave her clarity and a sense of purpose. She now needed to be able to describe what had happened for Teresa and for herself.
Let's come back to Isaiah Kalebu, the suspect and ultimately the man convicted of this crime. He didn't appear to do much to try to hide his tracks at all. I mean, literally that night.
Yes, very literally. There were bloody footprints in the house and fingerprints, and he had done nothing to try to avoid detection. And so this was something that worried detectives as well. It suggested that he had no fear of capture or consequence, and therefore they worried might do something like this again. And yeah, he was not very careful at covering his tracks, as you say, and they were able to capture him days later. But part of the reason that he was so careless in this, careless, you know, as far as criminals go, is that he was dealing at the time with a very serious mental disturbance, and we can probably talk more about that. But that disturbance I track in the book and show its course over many, many years.
Okay, much more to talk about as we talk further about While the City Slept with Eli Sanders, who won a Pulitzer Prize, as you heard, in feature writing for his reporting on this very case for The Stranger in Seattle. We'll come back and talk more with Eli about this murder and rape and the implications of how criminals are handled in the mental health system and vice versa. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Eli Sanders. He's the editor or the associate editor of The Stranger, a weekly newspaper in Seattle, and the author of a book about a famous Seattle murder from 2009 called While the City Slept, in which Teresa Butts and Jennifer Hopper, fiancés sharing living quarters in a fairly rundown part of Seattle, were attacked, both raped, and Teresa Butts murdered. Isaiah Kalebu has gone to prison for the crime, but there's a lot more to talk about with him and them, particularly in the context of mental health and the lack of it in Isaiah Kalebu's life. 800-838-3760 if you'd like to discuss this story or mental health generally, and our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's talk about the people in turn then. Teresa Butts, I mean, because there are great background details on each of the major characters in the book, the major figures in the story, and I hate to talk on those characters, but you know, this is what happens when you get them in the pages of a book. But they were real people. Teresa was a tough kid from a huge family, by all sounds of it, but real interest in helping people.
Yes, she, at the time of this crime, was on the board of a homeless advocacy organization. Jennifer was also, which is somewhat ironic because Isaiah Kalebu was homeless in the days leading up to this crime, and maybe in the weeks as well. But Teresa, as you said, was from a large family. She was born to a large Catholic family in St. Louis, and so grew up with a lot of brothers and sisters. It's a musical household. They were all very into music and singing and exploring the area around St. Louis. Teresa, after college, ended up working on a riverboat, or actually multiple riverboats that cruised up and down the Mississippi River and took her all over that part of the country. And her work on boats also led her to work on cruise ships that sailed out of Seattle, some of them. And that was how she became connected to the city of Seattle. And at a certain point, left the cruise ship life and began working in hotels, which, when you think about it, are kind of a stationary version of cruise ship work. She was a maid on the cruise ships, and she was a maid or head maid at the hotels that she worked in Seattle. And so she was doing that work and then eventually was working for a property management company when she met Jennifer Hopper one day. They both happened to have offices in the same building. And Jennifer is from a family, well, she was raised by a single mother. She was born outside of Santa Fe, New Mexico, but then moved back to Seattle pretty quickly. That's where her mother is from. And so she was raised by her mom and her grandparents, who noticed pretty early on that Jennifer had this amazing singing voice, and they didn't really know where it came from, but there it was. And so she got involved very early on in musical theater and developed a dream of being on Broadway, and was accepted into the Boston Conservatory after high school, which is a pretty prestigious and hard to get into conservatory, and she trained there to be able to use her voice as a Broadway actor, and moved to New York. Worked hard, tried out, but like a lot of people who moved to New York with this dream, didn't quite make it. The dream didn't become reality for her. And so she moved back to Seattle, still was involved in theater here, but was also working a day job, and as I said, in the same office building where Teresa ended up working. And so just by happenstance, these two women who had taken long roads to finding each other and also becoming comfortable with their own sexuality. I mean, Teresa from a Catholic family, this was a challenge for her, and Jennifer, it was a challenge for her as well, finding who she was meant to love. But then one day at work, they find each other, and not long after this, they are living together in South Park in a small red house that Teresa owned and planning to be married. This was 2009, and marriage was not legal in Washington State. Gay marriage was not legal in Washington State then. So this would have been a commitment ceremony, but for Teresa and Jennifer, it was marriage.
Eli Sanders is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about the victims of the crime in While the City Slept, A Love Lost to Violence and a Young Man's Descent into Madness. Coming back to Teresa, I mean, the obstacles to her acknowledging her sexuality were pretty clear in her family, and her father, Norbert Sr., I guess, was a major obstacle to it.
Well, he took some time getting there, yes. He was very Catholic, so was her mother, and so this was something that was incompatible with church teachings as they understood it. And it was, like I said, a long and difficult road for her. Teresa's mother, I think, came around a little more quickly than her father, and, you know, that's a common story for gay men and women who are coming out to their families, and it's not an uncommon story in Catholic families. And yeah, they were planning this marriage, but they were not sure whether Teresa's parents would come or be a part of it, although Teresa's mother had said, well, I'm coming to Seattle, I can't not be there, you know, for this big event in Teresa's life, and she was saying that she would probably come to the wedding, and Norbert Sr., Teresa's father, was also going to come to Seattle. So you see the love for their daughter there. They're not going to be there for this huge moment in her life. They just are wrestling with their understanding of their faith and whether they could be at the ceremony. But, you know, as Jennifer puts it, they love Teresa and they love Jennifer. And that was them. That was Teresa's family. It was a family that wrestled with its Catholic faith and its connection to who all of the children came to be, but it was a family full of love.
I think of Teresa and Jennifer as having some differences in their kinds of personalities. I think of Teresa, based on what you write in the book, as kind of the hard-nosed, tough one, and Jennifer is a bit softer.
Yes, that's true. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were, as we talked about in the beginning, both people who like to get to the point when you're talking to them. But yeah, Teresa was a little tougher, a little more rebellious. She was, you know, a soccer player in her youth, and her father told me a story of watching her daughter play and knocking a bunch of girls on the opposing team down, and the father coming out at halftime and saying, "What's going on? You're hurting people." And Teresa just spit on the ground and said, "Well, they got what's coming to them." There had been a rivalry between these teams. So that's Teresa. I mean, she's competitive, tough. She was a part of a softball team in Seattle that she loved, and people on the team loved her. And Jennifer Yeah, a little more emotionally, well, invested in emotional processing, and a little more sensitive, as you said, and a little more arts focused. You know, Teresa's more athletic and sports focused, really in love with her St. Louis Cardinals, who she would fly back to watch sometimes from Seattle. And Jennifer, the singer, you know, the more contemplative person in the relationship.
And in fact, Jennifer, you describe as an acute measurer of human energy. How does that express itself in her?
She is what you might call an empath, you know, someone who really is picking up what's going on in a conversation or in a room on a number of levels. And so when I say acute measure of human energy, she talks about feeling people's energy, you know, and not in a kind of woo-woo way. She just is picking up on the various different levels on which human beings communicate with one another. So she has a really incredible emotional intelligence, but also an acute awareness of where the people around her are emotionally.
I do have to giggle, though, about when they first get together, and Teresa just kind of lays everything out on the table, all the stuff that she has issues with. She just lets Jennifer know right up front.
Yeah, and Jennifer's response at one point when they're talking about this, because Teresa did have issues, and her family didn't hide this, and Teresa didn't hide it. She was, you know, everything out there, hard on her sleeve. She'd struggled a little bit with alcohol. She'd had a DUI in the years before she met Jennifer and told Jennifer about all this on their first date. You know, that was Teresa, like, getting everything out there in the open. And as they talked about these things more in their relationship, Jennifer's response was, well, this is an as-is sale, Teresa. You know, I accept you for who you are, is what she was saying.
Hmm. So Teresa Butts and Jennifer Hopper had planned a wedding in September of 2009. Didn't happen because they were both raped, and Teresa was murdered in July of 2009. Isaiah Kalebu went to prison for it. These are the basic details of the book, While the City Slept, A Love Lost to Violence and a Young Man's Descent into Madness. Eli Sanders wrote the book and joins us on the Jefferson Exchange. And you can join the discussion at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So let's shift to Isaiah now and talk about where he came from and how bumpy his upbringing was.
Sure. And it's important to say, because we're talking, when we talk about Isaiah's path, we're going to be talking about mental illness and its connection to the criminal justice system, but also the connection between mental illness and violence. And so to give some important context at first, the vast majority of people who live with mental illness of any kind are nonviolent. In fact, they are far more likely to be victims of violence than perpetrators. But there is a small percentage of people who have some violence connected to their serious mental illness, and Isaiah Kalebu was one of those people. He grew up in a really difficult family environment in Seattle, a fractured family, some accusations of domestic violence between the mother and the father, and in fact, records of this violence. And as he grew into adulthood, started to show signs of a serious mental illness that was a challenge for his family to deal with. Essentially, his family, which was of modest means and so didn't have a lot of free money for, you know, therapy or something like that, his family was essentially in over its head at a certain point in dealing with Isaiah's challenges, and so turned to the public mental health system. And his challenges became particularly acute in 2008 and 2009. And if you think back to those years, 2008 is the financial crisis, mm-hmm. and 2009 is its aftermath. And what did states around the country do in this period? Well, they turned to their safety nets first for cost savings and started slashing programs. And so there were $4.3 billion worth of cuts to state mental health budgets around the country in the wake of the Great Recession. And in Washington State, in 2009, the year when Isaiah Kalebu was headed toward these crimes, there was, just to pick one example of one cut, a $23 million cut to the state's mental health budget. So this is the context in which Isaiah really needed, but was interacting with a system that was struggling because of recent cuts, but had been neglected for a very long time. The Obama administration recently said what other administrations have said, and that's that our public mental health system is in a state of crisis. We have not invested enough in it for a very long time, and so it is not up to the challenge of anything, really, that it's charged with doing because it's overwhelmed, but it's also not up to the particular challenge of people like Isaiah Kalebu.
I want to get to some specifics about Isaiah's case, and I want to word the question carefully because he did have some family history of mental illness, I understand, and I want to know who it affected, but I also want to be clear on whether or not just because there's mental illness in your family, it necessarily means that you are prone to it.
Well, to your second question, I don't think that's a settled matter. I mean, our understanding of mental illness, even the term mental illness, is relatively new. So this is something that we're still learning about and understanding more and about, and I think the question of the hereditary aspect of it is not known fully and probably varies from, you know, type of disturbance to type of disturbance. But yes, Isaiah did have a family history of schizophrenia on his mother's side. And to give you just one example of the lack of attention that was paid to his disturbance when he started to interact with the public mental health system, I mean, to this day, Isaiah Kalebu does not have a firm diagnosis for what's going on with him. Before his trial, he had been diagnosed variously with perhaps schizophrenia, perhaps bipolar disorder, perhaps something else. There were state doctors who thought there was nothing wrong with him at all, but those state doctors existed at the same underfunded state hospital where doctors 2 years previous had said, no, he's suffering from bipolar disorder, which is not something you're cured of. So, you know, in 1 year, doctors said he had bipolar disorder. 2 years later, they said he had nothing. I mean, it was kind of indicative of the scattershot and unfocused approach to treating him. But he bounced in and out of the criminal justice and mental health system on the way to committing this crime. And the beginning of his trip in and out of these systems came in 2008 when he told his mother, who was becoming tired of dealing with his erratic behavior. He had had something like 20 jobs in the last 2 years. And he told her he had a job and he'd found a new place to live. And he took her to a house in kind of a neighborhood near the center of Seattle and said this was where he was going to live. Well, this house was filled with a financial services firm. It was a house that had a business in it. And he went in, said he owned the place, and started firing everyone. And police were called, but his mother very wisely prevailed on the police not to take him to jail because what he needed was an emergency psychiatric evaluation. So she had him taken to Harborview, which is where emergency psychiatric evaluations are conducted in the Seattle area. It's a big publicly funded, overwhelmed hospital. And Isaiah Kalebu was seen there. He was thought to be in a manic state of bipolar disorder, even though doctors were also told about his family history of schizophrenia. But he was deemed during the evaluation not to be a danger to himself or to other people, which is kind of the commonplace legal standard around the country for involuntary commitment. If you are a danger to yourself or others, then often the involuntary commitment statutes can be triggered and you can be held against your will. But Isaiah Kalebu was not seen as a danger to himself or to others in this evaluation, and so he was released. And as his defense attorneys later put it, he was released without follow-up aftercare, without prescription. And the next day, when his mother urged him to seek treatment and to take prescriptions for his mental illness, he turned on her very angrily. He threatened her the day after. He smashed her van's windows with a rock, hit her in the head with the metal end of a dog chain, and he was arrested for this. And then he began this journey in and out of the criminal justice and mental health systems, which ultimately led to him being out, unmonitored, untreated, in the months before he attacked Jennifer and Teresa.
He, as you note in the book, began to come to the attention of police around age 16. How old was he at the time of the murder?
he was 23, getting close to 24.
Did he know either Teresa or Jennifer before that night in July of 2009?
No, they were strangers. It appears to be just a crime of opportunity, so to speak. And, you know, the way the publisher has described the book, I actually like this description. It's a book about a crime of opportunity and the string of missed opportunities that made it possible.
And so how often had Isaiah come in contact with police before the rapes and murder?
Oh, a number of times. I mean, I described one where the police were called because of his behavior at this financial services firm that he claimed that he owned. So that's one. And then they were called again almost the next day or 2 days later when he attacked his mother. So that's two. And he had some interaction just on a kind of misdemeanor level with police even before that. But those interactions are more connected, in my view, to his poverty. He was a man of very few means. And so after the second interaction with police, he was taken to court and began this path in and out of the criminal justice and mental health systems. But that actually was not even his last interaction with police. When he was free and probably shouldn't have been, he had others.
All right, much more to talk about While the City Slept, A Love Lost to Violence and a Young Man's Descent into Madness. Eli Sanders is the author of the book and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk more about the circumstances of the case and the implications for the interaction of the criminal justice and mental health systems when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Eli Sanders, associate editor of The Stranger, a weekly newspaper in Seattle. He was reporting on a crime case for The Stranger several years ago, won him a Pulitzer Prize for feature reporting, and that grew into the book While the City Slept, A Love Lost to Violence and a Young Man's Descent into Madness. It details the double rape and single murder Teresa Butts and Jennifer Hopper attacked in the house they shared together 2 months short of their intended wedding in Washington State. Teresa dead, and Isaiah Kalebu picked up and charged with the crime and sent to prison for it after a trial. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We mentioned much earlier in the conversation, Eli, that Isaiah didn't seem to make much effort to conceal what he'd done, left tracks of blood, footprints, all that sort of thing. How was he eventually found?
He was found wandering in Magnuson Park, which is a park to the north of Seattle. And he was found because a fingerprint lifted at the crime scene was matched to a fingerprint from another break-in where nothing really was stolen. But he had been messing around with a door at City Hall in Auburn, which is a city south of Seattle. And a policeman lifted a fingerprint, sent it to a crime lab for that crime, and there were no matches. But when this crime in 2009 occurred, they matched the new fingerprint from the new crime to the old fingerprint from the old small crime, and there happened to be a videotape of the attempted crime in the earlier years, and so they had an image of his face. And that went out on the news and on blogs. The Stranger, the paper that I work for, put it up on our blog. And pretty soon Isaiah's mom called the police and said, "That's my son. Please don't shoot him."
Oh, wow. And so was he taken without incident?
He was, yes.
Mm-hmm. We got a call here. Let's go to Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Eli Sanders.
Good morning. First of all, a long time back here now, I've been meaning to call in. I'm very sorry I got zinged by an online posting that looked real to me. You corrected it. Congratulations.
Oh,
I'm very happy for that. But in this particular case, question and a comment. The question is, has this fellow ever been diagnosed with anything that has stuck? And then secondly, has anyone ever checked this man for fetal alcohol syndrome? The second comment is that with the with the Reagan administration, we created a curious symmetry with the old Soviet Russia. In that time, we dumped all of the mentally ill people out onto the streets, and the first thing they did, of course, was get into trouble and wind up in jail. In the Soviet Union, it was held that there was no crime because it was a workers' paradise, and as a result, you had to be crazy to commit a crime. So we created a curious symmetry where you had to be crazy to commit a crime in Russia, and in America, you had to be criminal to be crazy.
All right. We'll talk about deinstitutionalization in just a moment, Paul. Thanks for that. Let's ask the other questions then of Eli. So was he diagnosed with anything, and was fetal alcohol syndrome ever part of the process?
Well, he has never been seen long enough by any single psychiatric professional, and he's been seen, you know, over brief periods by a number at this point. But no, he's never been seen by anyone long enough to arrive at a firm diagnosis. He's a challenging person to diagnose, but the fact is his path through the system put him in front of people so briefly, and the different parts of the system's mandates left them able to say, well, we've just done our small part, here you go, we're passing you over to someone else, that, you know, no one ever arrived at a firm diagnosis for what's going on with him. I didn't hear anything in any of my research about fetal alcohol syndrome having been raised or looked into. The answer is no, it's never come up. But, you know, your point about the criminal justice system, it's worth repeating again that the vast majority of people who live with mental illness in the United States or anywhere are more likely to be victims of crimes than perpetrators. But for the small percentage of mentally ill people who commit crimes, right now, because our public mental health systems and our public health systems are so overwhelmed and underfunded, they end up being funneled into our prison system. And we now have 10 times as many mentally ill people in our country's jails and prisons as we do in publicly funded state mental health hospitals, which gives you a sense of how misaligned and backward our spending priorities are right now.
So let's talk about that then, because, and as Paul mentioned it, he put it upon Ronald Reagan, but as you point out, and other people have as well, it started earlier than that. And by the way, a president doesn't do stuff all by himself. There's 535 people in Congress who have to have at least some say in the matter, usually. So this actually started in the mid-50s, and by the numbers, how much has mental health care changed? The how much of the state hospitals really emptied out since that time?
Well, yes, and it started even earlier than the 50s. There's a history in this country that traces back much further than that, when we were, the policy actually was just to jail people who were seen as mentally ill, and we didn't even have the term mentally ill at that time, but the policy was just to jail them. And then when the conditions of these jails were exposed, the movement toward publicly funded mental hospitals began. And then in the 50s and 60s, it turned out that the conditions at those hospitals were not great either. Think of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And also that people were being sent to these hospitals for no good reason, because they were difficult, or to, in someone's opinion, or the wrong skin color. So no good reasons behind a lot of people's involuntary commitments. And so President John F. Kennedy in the 60s, at the urging of reform-minded psychiatrists, began what's called the community treatment movement, and essentially began emptying out state-funded psychiatric hospitals with the idea that people could and should be integrated into their communities even as they were struggling with mental illness and be treated in their communities. Well, it is a very nicely motivated idea, but it has never in all the decades since been backed by appropriate funding. And so we get to today where the way of dealing with people like Isaiah Kalebu is community treatment. Ultimately, you know, in that path that I was describing for him earlier, he ultimately landed in community treatment, and he stopped going. And because community treatment is so underfunded and overwhelmed in Washington State, as it is in many, many states, no one noticed. And so he wandered, as his defense attorneys put it, accompanied only by his dog and his delusions, for a long period of time until he encountered Teresa Butts and Jennifer Hopper.
So community health care, I mean, mental health care was supposed to be able to let us open the doors and push people out. So no, people weren't sent away anymore was what was supposed to happen. They stay in the communities from which they came. But then if there's no programs to support them, obviously you get issues here. What was it ever at least envisioned? Was there a plan on paper someplace that Congress has never enacted, or what happened?
Well, there have been many reports over the years diagnosing the problem in American mental health care and saying there's a crisis that needs to be addressed. But yes, people just never acted. Presidents never acted. Congress never acted. President George W. Bush in 2001 and the years around it had something called the New Freedom Commission on Mental Health going. He had made a campaign promise to reform America's mental health system. And that commission, you know, said a lot of things about how the system is broken and we need to move to a system where we focus on early intervention, which really would have been beneficial over the course of Isaiah Kalevu's life. There were so many points where early intervention could have perhaps redirected him in a better direction, or at least moved him to the point that his final destination would not have been these crimes against Jennifer and Teresa. But so Bush's commission, the New Freedom Commission on Mental Health, said, you know, we need a system where at the first sign of trouble, there's appropriate interventions and on and on and on. And it called for a radical transformation or a fundamental transformation. And that just never happened. Here we are in 2016, and it's not happened.
You mentioned, I think, in the book that a major mental hospital actually closed as part of the cuts in Washington State just the year before the murder. Is that right?
It lost a number of beds. It hasn't closed, mm-hmm. but the number of beds it has have been slashed, and it continues to struggle. It's called Western State Hospital, and it's currently in trouble with the federal government for the quality of its service. So the federal government is threatening to withdraw money, which will make its service even worse, and the state is trying to find money to put in. You know, one thing that I've been trying to share with people about the misaligned priorities that we have when it comes to helping the mentally ill in this country, the panel that I was talking about, the Bush panel, the New Freedom Commission on Mental Health, put the annual indirect cost of mental illness to the U.S. economy at something like $79 billion. So there is a lot of money that could be saved by investing more money in helping people who are living and struggling with mental illness and helping their families, by the way. And in this specific case, the case of Isaiah Kalevu in Washington State, the cost of jailing Isaiah Kalevu while he was awaiting trial, the cost of prosecuting him at public expense and defending him at public expense because he was indigent and didn't have money for his own defense, and then the cost of paying for his appeals, and now the cost of incarcerating him for life in Washington State, I've tallied all of that up in the book, and the cost is going to be over $3 million to Washington State taxpayers. So that's to say nothing of the incalculable cost to Jennifer, to Teresa's family, to Isaiah's family, to the wide ripples that this crime has had on many, many people. But if you want to talk in terms of tax dollars, we have spent and will spend over $3 million to deal with the crimes that Isaiah Kalevu committed, and it would not have cost over $3 million to have more appropriate interventions earlier in his life.
Which raises one of the major questions that the book brings up, and I must say that the pacing is stellar. I mean, you make us wait a long time to find this out, but we don't mind. But how was he even able to stand trial given his apparent mental state?
Well, this is an interesting legal situation. You have to be competent to stand trial. And in Washington State, and probably in a number of other states, but in Washington State in particular, the standard for competency is, as the judge put it at Isaiah Kalevu's trial, a minimal standard. You just need to understand the charges against you and be able to assist your attorneys. And he was found to be competent enough to stand trial, but he was also found by the judge to be mentally ill. And you can understand this maybe in a different way. I mean, there are people who live and function and are very productive members of society and are very competent, but who live with a mental illness. So this is essentially what the judge was saying, that he was competent enough to be tried for these crimes and face justice for them. I think the major point is that his mental illness was, for him, associated with violence. And if there had been earlier intervention, he wouldn't have ended up in this strange situation anyway, in which we were trying to evaluate, we, the state of Washington, just how competent or not competent he was in the context of a criminal trial. It would have been much better to be evaluating him over a long period of time. And this trial lasted, the trial and the hearings preceding it, over a year, I think. It would have been much better to spend over a year sitting with Isaiah in a more therapeutic environment and saying, okay, what is going on with you? How can we help you? How can we treat you? How can we steer you away from bad outcomes?
So Isaiah Kalebu in prison, Teresa Butts dead, Jennifer Hopper, now Jennifer Sanders, is that right?
No. Jennifer Hopper.
Okay.
Sanders is my last name.
That's right. Okay, I got the names crossed up here somewhere.
That's all right. There's a number of them in the book. But yeah, Jennifer Hopper has gone on to live a really inspiring life. I mean, just to be able to go on after what happened to her would have been amazing. And to be able to go on and testify in public, against the person who attacked you and killed your fiance, that's stunning. And more than that, she has now gone on to work with survivors of sexual violence, or the other crime survivors. And she's part of something that was started by friends of Teresa and herself called the Angel Band Project. Like I said, Teresa's family is musical, and Jennifer has this amazing singing voice that she was hoping would take her to Broadway. So they've put on fundraising concerts and have created an album and have a whole nonprofit called the Angel Band Project that they use to raise money for music therapy programs for survivors of sexual violence. So just an amazingly purposeful life since the crime.
We will look up the Angel Band Project and link to it from our webpage. I want to thank Eli Sanders for joining us today to talk about While the City Slept, A Love Lost to Violence and a Young Man's Descent into Madness. Eli, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, take care.